Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tonight we're talking about the life and music of Frank Zappa.
Mr. America, walk on by your schools that do not teach. Mr. America, walk on by the minds that won't be reached. Mr. America, try to hide the emptiness that's you inside. But once you find that the way you lied and all the corny tricks you tried will not forestall the rising tide of hungry freaks, Daddy. Left behind of the great society.
The song Hungry Freak's Daddy from the 1966 album Freak Out, Frank Zappa's first record with the Mothers of Invention and a landmark in rock history. Freak Out was one of the first cutting-edge rock concept albums made by a revolutionary musician in an era of revolution. Frank Zappa was savagely critical of American consumer society and conformity, but he was also scornful of what he saw as the shallow, posturing sybarites of the 60s counterculture. He revered the challenging composers Stravinsky and Varese and dreamed of himself becoming a serious composer of classical music, but it was restless musical invention that elevated him in the eyes of fans in the United States and especially abroad. The Czech president playwright Václav Havel once told Zappa that he loved Zappa's 1975 album Bongo Fury and often listened to it in the dark days before the fall of the Berlin Wall and the Velvet Revolution. Frank Zappa died of prostate cancer in 1993. He was just 52. Our guest tonight, the famed chronicler and biographer of the 1960s, Barry Miles, knew him well. And of the labels people want to apply to Zappa, legend, cult hero, misogynist, Barry Miles says the hugely troubled, hugely talented Frank Zappa was, above all, like Neil Cassidy, Hunter S. Thompson, Allen Ginsberg, and Lenny Bruce, an American iconoclast. Tonight on Point, the life and music of rock revolutionary Frank Zappa. Joining us now from London is Barry Miles, author of many critically acclaimed books on pop culture icons and the best-selling biography of Paul McCartney. His new biography is titled simply Zappa. Barry Miles, good evening. Welcome to On Point.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for being with us, and what a detailed life that paints such a picture of a man and a time. I wish you'd dive in just from the top, Barry Miles, and give us your sense of where Frank Zappa sits, not only in the kind of musical pantheon, but in the cultural pantheon. You call him not only a musician, but a journalist. Why?
Well, he, in many ways, his approach to rock and roll was that of a journalist or an anthropologist. In many ways, he wanted to record all of the little subcultures, the groupies, the sort of rock and roll subculture that he was a part of. And then he expanded out from there and basically became a poet of the American suburbs. He would celebrate American suburban sprawl. His albums encompass the wording from billboards, the long ads for used tires you get in Los Angeles late at night. All of these elements of America got turned into music in a very sort of John Cage sort of way. So he transcended most American rock and roll and became something a bit beyond that, I think. He used rock and roll as his medium, but he himself was more of an artist who could turn his hand to almost anything.
You say he celebrated the American suburbs, but in many ways he eviscerated the culture of those suburbs. He was absolutely ruthless in his cynicism about that culture.
That's true, but this was the only culture he knew. He grew up in the Mojave Desert in a place called Lancaster, California, out by the Edwards Air Force Base. Before that, he'd been pretty much on the move right across America. His His father was in military contracting. Pretty much every year or every couple of years they would up and move, but never to the centre of a city. It was always some suburban area in the various places sort of strung out right along the foothills outside Los Angeles, places like Cucamonga he finished up in, for instance. And there was no architecture there to see. There was nothing to really influence him except the signs of consumer culture, the billboards, and the constant advertising on painted on the back of seats, you know, bus seats. I don't know, aircraft flying over, towing ads. I mean, everywhere he was surrounded by American consumer culture and no other real sense of place. So to him, this is how you defined a city. When once asked about how he knew about the countries he visited in Europe or in the Far East, he said he got enough information just driving in from the airport looking at the billboards. And from that, you know, he could tell what kind of country he was in.
And this is his approach to
American culture.
Right, and by no means the kind of high sheen, plush velvet end of American culture. It was the rough, the raggedy, the kind of, as you say, out on the very last outskirts of the city, out where all the claims of nobility and grandeur looked pretty ratty and tatty and didn't really add up. You say that Frank Zappa's ultimate message, his one overriding idea in quoting him, was it's that the emperor's not wearing any clothes, never has, never will. He didn't believe the way the country was told to see itself.
No, he didn't. He didn't. He grew up, obviously, believing it. He went through the American school system. But then he was basically set up for a bust, a pornography bust in San Bernardino, where he was conned into making a so-called pornographic tape.
Which was really a joke. I mean, it was a kind of send-up of oral sex. The cops said they would do it for a Kiwanis club or something.
That's right.
But he did it really as a joke.
And also he added a music soundtrack to it, which is typical of Zappa, of course.
Right.
And it was the kind of thing which, you know, only about 6 or 7 years later, Donna Summer had a number one hit with.
Some heavy breathing here. Right. But it landed him in jail for 10 days in San Bernardino. I want to come back and look at exactly the impact that had on him, but I want to keep Frank Zappa's music in here with us as well. Here from his 1968 album, We're Only In It For the Money, is Who Needs the Peace Corps?
What's there to live for? Who needs the Peace Corps? Think I'll just drop out. I'll go to Frisco, buy a wig, and sleep on Owsley's floor. Walk past the wig store, dance at the Fillmore. I'm completely stoned, I'm hippy and I'm trippy, I'm a gypsy on my own. I'll stay a week and get the crabs and take a bus back home. I'm really just a pony, but forgive me 'cause I'm stoned. Must have a place where phony hippies meet. Psychedelic dungeons popping up on every street. Go to San Francisco. How I love you, how I love you, how I love you, how I love you, Frisco. How I love you, how I love you, how I love you, how I love you. Oh, my hair is getting good in the back.
Frank Zappa, 1968, Who Needs the Peace Corps? I'm talking to Barry Miles, biographer of Frank Zappa. The new book is Zappa. Barry Miles, I want to build back up to that moment in the San Bernardino jail where, as you describe it, Frank Zappa really sort of cut loose from all the normative thinking about what the United States was or might be. You mentioned just briefly his family's background, immigrants from Italy, from Sicily. His father came over, I guess, as a young boy.
That's it.
And you mentioned just in passing, but it seemed critical. His father worked in the defense industry, first around Baltimore, and in some very, well, literally noxious ends of the defense industry.
Oh, very much so. Yeah, he was working with poison gas during the war. And Frank's father would come home in the evenings with all these patches on his arm. He would be paid like $5, you know, a week or something to test out these new poison patches, gave him, you know, terrible sort of illnesses. He always had a cold and running nose and eyes watering. And at one point, Zappa's father brought home a huge bag of DDT, for instance, which he claimed was so safe that, you know, you could eat it on a sandwich. And we now know that that's carcinogenic.
Not exactly true. And you write about how in the Zappa family closet, in their very humble house there, hung a gas mask, just in case the chemical weapons tanks broke.
That's it. Well, one for each member of the family, yes. Yes, everybody did on the estate there. It was a military estate attached to the American base there.
So when you grew up with a gas mask, you describe it, or Frank Zappa did, as his favorite toy as a kid, his space helmet. You start right away with something that's not exactly the home on the range view of America.
No, that's true. That's true. And in fact, I mean, he was clearly suffering from the environment because when his father got posted down to Florida when he was about 10 years old, all of his symptoms cleared up. It was only when he returned to the Baltimore area that, you know, he got it healthy again, you know, and always had problems with his stomach and with his hearing and things like this. I mean, just typical examples, actually, of low-level poisoning.
There's a wonderful song, the title I'm forgetting now, Prelude. What was it? Prelude to...
Prelude to the afternoon of a sexually aroused gas mask.
Yes, exactly. Now, his Italian immigrant background came in for some pummeling later in his life as well. You write that he ate so much, was fed, I should say, so much pasta as a kid, he would never eat it growing up. He would never touch onion or garlic. I mean, he walked away from the whole package, ultimately.
He did, yes. No, he had the classic reaction against his rather authoritarian father, who was basically a Sicilian patriarch. You know, he expected his son to behave and do everything that he was told, and Frank didn't do this. The rest of the family were subservient, but not Frank. It's a sort of classic 60s story, you know, his father hated his long hair and all the rest of it. And Frank reacted by throwing the whole lot out, basically, the baby with the bathwater. And he dumped his Roman Catholicism, he dumped his belief in the American education system, the family, everything, you know, was slung out there. And he tried to make a whole set of new models and new ways of living that he thought would be better.
But you hear ultimately, above all things, that kind of ragged exurbia culture he grew up in, as you say, in so many towns at the edges of cities, whether it was Baltimore or San Diego or Los Angeles. And then later, you just look down the list of the Zappa Top 10, as at least selected by some group of fans, watermelons and Easter hay, Inca Roads, peaches and regalia, black napkins, Yo Mama, Willie the Pimp, What's New in Baltimore, The Black Page, King Kong, Torture Never Stops, G-Spot, Tornado. This is an alternate view of the world. This is not the mainstream anymore.
That's true. That's true. No, he never was mainstream, although he did hope to be mainstream. Early on in his career, he worked as an independent record producer, doing sort of knockoffs of the hits that were in the charts, but he never ever got them right. His versions were always, you know, they were too much of a parody. They were too weird that no one ever bought them. So even if he did a surfing record, it sounded so strange, and he would have some kind of feedback guitar on there that everyone thought it was just distorted. He was never mainstream. He could never quite hack it.
And didn't really, well, maybe wanted to, but it wasn't his thing. Those 10 days in the San Bernardino County Jail after being set up for a porno charge, you say, really changed the way he looked at the world. It was hot, he was hungry, it was filthy, it was crowded. And what was the transformation there?
I think prior to that, he'd always been pretty cynical. But this was he just had no idea that this kind of thing happened in America, that he was literally set up. And his lawyer said, you know, I'm sure, I thought everybody knew about that guy. You know, he spends his whole time going around, you know, setting people up for this kind of bust. He hadn't ever encountered the idea that America could be corrupt, that the institutions that he'd grown up and been taught to respect could actually be corrupt. Mm. And it flipped him right over, really. I mean, he spent, really, in many ways, the rest of his life trying to make that pornographic tape over and over again and thrusting it down the throat of the American public
or
the world. You know?
You're right, exactly that. You say everything he'd been taught at school about the American life was a lie. He would not be fooled again. He would be rubbing it in the face of respectable society, making America see itself as it really was. In any way, in the Frank Zappa view, phony, mendacious, shallow, and ugly, a tough, tough, iconoclastic critic, a kind of bohemian, not exactly romantic, but maybe in his own way. Barry Miles, author of the new biography, Zappa, please stand by. We'll be right back with more on the life and music of Frank Zappa here from 1969 from his album Hot Rats, Peaches and Regalia. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the life and music of Frank Zappa here from a live June 1971 performance with John Lennon in New York City.
Hey, sit down and cool it for a minute so you can hear what we're going to do. And for those of you in the band who have no idea what's about to happen, this is an A minor, and it's not standard blues changes. But it's close.
This is a song that I used to sing when I was in the cabin in Liverpool. I haven't done it since, so...
John Lennon with Frank Zappa in 1971 in New York City. And off they go. My guest tonight is Barry Miles, author of the new biography of Frank Zappa, entitled simply Zappa. It was a long way from those rough outskirts of L.A. and San Diego to that stage in New York City. You report here, Barry Miles, a note that Frank Zappa sent to his aunt and uncle back in Baltimore as a teenager, maybe just 14 or 15 years old, asking if he can come spend the summer with them. And he writes in that real teenager way, he says, the second reason is, after saying that he wants to see all the family, I think I have invented something new in the way of music. Where did a teenager get off thinking he'd represented or created something new in music? What was he on to?
Well, he originally wanted to be a classical composer, and from the age of about 15 or 16, he originally wrote out music notation, but of course he'd never heard any of it played, so he had no idea what it really sounded like. And he didn't write any rock and roll songs until he was 21. But his original concept of classical music was he thought that you just had to make the dots look really good graphically, you know, like a painting.
In other words, the visual
he had
of
no
the
idea
notation
that there was a structure
on the
behind
page.
It,
you know? And it was Igor Stravinsky and another who were his great inspirations.
Edgar Varèse, who he was particularly keen on. He read a number of articles about Varèse, which said that his music was just complete cacophony. It was just nothing but cymbals and drums and gongs banging, and he just thought, this is for me, this is absolutely terrific. And he spent several years looking for the record, and then when he found it, he was absolutely knocked out. He thought this was the most wonderful stuff. And from Varèse, he moved out to the other school of Vienna composers. And basically, he was influenced by high modernism. And he was writing this kind of stuff, but it's very, very hard to get that played. It's always very hard to get your music played, particularly if you're a teenager living in the Mojave Desert. So he figured the only way to do this was to get himself a rock and roll band and teach them how to play his music, and then he would at least be able to hear it.
He tried.
And also maybe make some money.
Right. They tried. They played lounge songs when they needed to scrounge money together. He was trying to do film on the side. And then he gradually became part of that wild scene, kind of in the valleys and distant burbs around L.A., where suddenly had the Birds and the Doors and Grace Slick and Clapton and Mick Jagger kind of hanging out in cabins in the middle of nowhere in cottages and overgrown canyons. What was that scene, Barry Miles, and how did Frank Zappa fit into it?
Well, it was very much the L.A. equivalent of what was going on in San Francisco or in the Lower East Side in New York or King's Road in London. It was the sort of swinging London, the hippie 60s countercultural thing happening. And what happened in L.A., the area around Laurel Canyon, up in the hills there, was taken over by musicians and turned into basically a musical colony. At that point, it wasn't, these houses weren't million-dollar houses like they are now. Yeah. They were pretty much shacks or places to do with keeping horses and things like that. And you could get a little cabin or a little cottage up there really cheaply. And it became an incredibly fertile place because literally the doors, the birds, the mamas and the papas, the monkeys, all these different people were all living there and jamming together and hanging out together and doing all the countercultural things that people did, sex and drugs and rock and roll. Zappa was very central to this because he took on a sort of role of the sort of resident guru in many ways, although he's actually no older than most of them. He seemed to be, rather than part of it, he was more the philosopher behind the scene. He would often write articles in the Los Angeles Free Press, which was the local underground paper, yeah, talking about his views on how to, freak out and how to change the society that people were living in. So it was more than just rock and roll as far as he was concerned.
It's language that we associate with the 60s and the hippie era of freak out, but you describe him, and Camille Paglia, when she reviewed your book in the New York Times, taking away from that, your description, his persona, kind of half-angry beat hipster, beat as opposed to hippie, the sort of 50s instead of the 60s, and half-loopy Mad Magazine satirist. He was not, in fact, right on the beam with that 60s cultural impulse.
He wasn't. One of the main things that he differed from them in was that he was opposed to the use of drugs, which he thought simply befuddled people and stopped them being really clear about seeing society as it really was.
And, though he had no trouble with high-octane cigarettes and coffee.
I'll say. No, he was constantly drinking what he called his the black water, which he must have been on a caffeine high like no one has ever had before, and endlessly chain-smoking. But drugs were out, and for everybody in his band, drugs were out.
What did he mean, then, by freak out?
It was really in the first place, sexual liberation. You have to remember the period he was coming from, the early 60s there. This was the end of the sort of Eisenhower era, when women, once they left school, suddenly turned into 35-year-old women, sort of middle-aged people. There was no real, nothing much in between. People suddenly wore all this, the thick makeup and the sprayed hair and everything. And he was very much in favor of a free love and a complete Dionysian breakthrough, which would cut through all this materialism and all of the conformity that he saw surrounding him in these desert communities, the endless little identical suburban houses. He was looking for shock. He was using rock and roll and the new sort of 60s ideas of sexual freedom to cut through many of people's preconceived ideas and try and find some new way of living.
And always that shock factor. You say he was a great namer, and of course his first child, his daughter, famously named Moon Unit, his son Dweezil, and then all the songs, Burnt Weenie Sandwich, Help I'm a Rock, Don't You Ever Wash That Thing, The Meek Shall Inherit Nothing, and I think maybe most famously in the really broad popular culture, Don't Eat the Yellow Snow. We're talking tonight about Frank Zappa. Let's get a little more of his music here. Quite a wonderful song from 1975 from the album Bongo Fury, Vaclav Havel's favorite album. This was Frank Zappa's contribution to the country's bicentennial celebration. Not exactly made in Washington, D.C. Here's the song, 200 Years Old.
I was sitting in a breakfast room in Allentown, Pennsylvania, 6 o'clock in the morning. Got up too early. It was a terrible mistake. Sitting there face to face with a 75-cent glass of orange juice about as big as my finger and a bowl of horribly foreshortened corn flakes. And I said to myself, this is the life.
200 years old. She told me she couldn't walk no more. She's 200 years old. She told me she couldn't walk no more.
Boy, she's been so she tried to grow a mustache.
Frank Zappa from the 1975 album Bongo Fury. There's 200 Years Old. My guest is Barry Miles, biographer of Frank Zappa. You put this man, this artist, in the lineage of American iconoclasts Neil Cassady, William S. Burroughs, Ken Kesey, Lenny Bruce, Hunter S. Thompson, How do you see him fitting there, Barry Miles?
I think largely because he was very much a loner. He always said that he had no friends at all except his family. He had to have complete control over all of his music, over his surroundings, his whole environment. You know, to the extent that he, in fact, started his own record company in the end, so that he was not dependent on anyone else's, goodwill, or, no one else could ever have any say over the covers, over the mixing, over the track order or anything. He had to have control. And in many ways, this is also something that I knew with people like Allen Ginsberg or William Burroughs. They were very much on the outside there. They were... they had friends, but they were very, very much loners, I think. I mean, their views were so far out of kilter with everyday society that one would have to say they were part of a counterculture, really. Not the hippie counterculture necessarily, but
a different
counterculture.
An older one, maybe. You put it in the lineage of the idea of the romantic genius, almost a late 19th, early 20th century idea.
Yes.
The artist as romantic genius apart from all.
Oh, yes. I think with Zappa, you could even go back as far as Whitman and Poe and people like this. I mean, he really does fall into that lineage, I think, because he's so much more than just a rock musician. I mean, he had the political aspect. Just from the titles you were reading out, you can see that his facility with words was astonishing. I mean, he was he was a poet in many respects, even though he I think rather threw away his lyrics. You know, he always regarded them as secondary to the music and dashed them off really, really quickly.
And yet,
I think he spent more time on them, yeah. I mean, we could have had a brilliant writer there.
Yeah. And yet, as a journalist, as you say, the words, the messages meant a lot to him. You quote Elizabeth Wilson from her book Bohemians, The Glamorous Outcast, kind of getting at the heart of the mold that you see Frank Zappa in, that romantic genius, artist against society, embodies dissidence, opposition, critical of the status quo, components of the myth, transgression, excess, sexual outrage, eccentric behavior, outrageous appearance, nostalgia, and poverty, all those his, though he didn't end up poor, he ended up in a big mansion in L.A.
That's right. But it was hardly a standard mansion. I mean, most of the money had gone into the huge recording studio in the basement. I think when he first bought it, it was a pretty nice place, but you would hardly call it a Beverly Hills, mansion. There was no columns or anything outside. He just tacked on bits as he needed them, so that one of his later sons had a bedroom that you had to get to up a sort of spiral staircase out in the backyard, and it was up on the roof somewhere.
And not a lot.
This was his approach.
Yeah, and not a lot of love inside, as you describe it. You quote his second wife, Gail, saying, "Frank did not love." And of course, there's the famous story of Moon Unit, the daughter of Frank Zappa, when she was 13, slipping a note under his studio door to, quote, introduce herself and her ideas to her father, who was in his studio locked away all the time, all night anyway.
Yes, he worked through the night and slept through the day. And also for a large part of the time when the children were growing up, he was also on tour for just about half of each year. So they hardly ever saw him. He was very much a mythical figure. There was a sort of a sense of his presence in the house, but they weren't allowed to disturb him. I mean, this was like the one thing you must not ever do is disturb Dad. And so in the end, Moon, at the age of, I think she was 13 and a half or just 14 at the time, did literally send him a note because she really wanted to have human contact with him. Mm. And he was just a complete workaholic. He worked staggering hours, 16, 17, 18 hours a day.
And yet there could be a softer, gentler side, at least as one listens to the music, thinking of from 1975, One Size Fits All, Sofa Number One. You knew Frank Zappa, Barry Miles. You're described as ambivalent about him personally. You call him a cold nihilist. Said he felt no real emotions.
I think that he was unable to express himself directly, and it came out through the music. There's some very, very tender passages in his music. Beautiful, beautiful compositions, which show that he was, even if he was unable to get into direct contact with his emotions and feelings when he was dealing with his children, let's say, he was, those feelings were there. I mean, he wasn't a complete robot or anything. And I think actually towards the very end of his life, he did relax more. And unfortunately, it was only when he was finally ill in his terminal illness that you know, he finally accepted the idea of friendship and that other people could love him and that he could love them back. But it took most of his life before he reached that position.
And very, very tough on the musicians who played with him in those all the years before, with the Mothers of Invention. It was a great place to kind of get your ticket clipped as having played with Frank Zappa. But it was hard, as you describe it. He was tough on these musicians with him.
He was tough, but it was like being in the Miles Davis band or the Art Blakey band. I mean, if that was in your CV, you could get a job anywhere in any studio as a session musician, because he made a point of studying the musicians' work and seeing what their limits were and what their great strengths were, and then he would push them so that if they were playing the French horn, he would get them to play a higher note than they'd ever attempted before, you know, and he would always stretch them. And then when he'd found their limits, he would then take it back a couple of notches so that they didn't mess up on, you know, when they were actually recording. But he wrote for the particular musicians.
And what about his ambitions to be a really serious composer, thinking of Verges and Stravinsky? How close did he come?
I think he came pretty high on the list of American contemporary composers. And this is because he didn't draw a very strong line between sort of classical composition and rock and roll. And many of the melodies that appear on, particularly on albums like Hot Rats, he was able to simply transcribe for different instrumentation, and then you could have it played by a string quartet or by a computer, actually, towards the end.
He loved the synclavier. He said this synthetic piano kind of music maker, he said it freed him from the imperfections of human musicians.
Well, he was able to use this extraordinary synthesizer, the synclavier, that was able to take samples of all the different instruments that he had about the place. And anyone who would come into the studio, he would get them to sing or to perform, and everything would be put down on tape and then sampled. And eventually he found himself in a position where he didn't need musicians anymore. He was finally freed from all of their little problems, and the fact that they might get arrested and that they might have a hangover when they're supposed to be playing a difficult passage. He had it all on tape, and the great thing about the synclavier, as far as he was concerned, was that you could take any instrument and take it way beyond its normal boundaries. You could make a flute play higher than it's possible to play. You could make timpani play faster than any human could ever play. So he finished up really in total control of his music. Except, unfortunately, the only place you could play it was using that particular machine, which now you'll only ever find in a museum.
Yeah, all right. It's passed out of our current technical use, but there was Frank Zappa in the basement studio of that big Tudor house in L.A. Let's listen to just a bit of that era here from 1986 from the album Jazz from Hell. The cut is Jazz from Hell. Frank Zappa. I'm talking tonight with Barry Miles, Zappa biographer. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Frank Zappa biographer Barry Miles. Here from 1982, Frank Zappa's Valley Girl with his daughter, Moon Unit.
Like, oh my God!
Valley Girl!
Like, totally!
Valley Girl!
And Cedar was like, so bitchin'.
Valley Girl!
There's like the Galleria.
Valley Girl!
And like all these like really great shoe stores. I like, love going into like clothing stores and stuff. I like buy the neatest. Could you, like, just picture me in, a leather teddy? Yeah, right. Hurt me. I'm sure, no way. He was, like, freaking me out. He called me a beastie. That was, like, his totally bliss. He goes, like, bag your face, I'm sure.
Valley girl, she's a valley girl. Valley girl, she's a valley girl. Open wide, for sure, she's a valley girl. So sweet and good.
We're talking tonight about the music and life and delicious iconoclasm of musician-journalist, as my guest tonight calls him, Frank Zappa, there performing Valley Girl with his daughter Moon Unit. That is probably, for many Americans of a certain age, the best-known Zappa song from later on, Barry Miles, kicking up his heels.
Yes, very much. I mean, I think it was a matter of some regret to him that his two biggest hits in America were both novelty records. You know, he really did want to be known for his classical compositions. Nonetheless, I think this shows Zappa in full flight, really. I mean, it's got all the cynicism, but it's also got a brilliant bass line and all the rest of it. It's a classic piece of Zappa rock and roll.
You turn to Picasso, a quote from Picasso, to describe the way Zappa felt about the world, saying, "We must wake people up, upset their way of identifying things. It is necessary to create unacceptable images." He was very conscious of doing that, and it worked. He must have taken heat when he stepped out of his cocoon, out into that kind of culture that he was mocking.
Oh, very much. I mean, he found it almost impossible to get played on the radio, for instance. This is one of the reasons why he had to ultimately get control of his own records, because he was constantly being censored. His original record company, MGM, were always putting little sections of the records on backwards so that the rude words wouldn't offend anyone. And then they wouldn't print the libretto, the lyrics on the back of the album, because, again, they thought they might involve themselves in a censorship case. Mm. Constantly, he was up against problems. But he kept pushing through. I mean, part of the message was that, you know, you have to break these barriers. A lot of people, me included, used to criticize him, saying that if only he would make these things a little bit more acceptable, then he would reach a lot more people. But he said that it was actually the socially unacceptable part, you know, the un-PC part of the right. of the lyrics that was actually that was the message.
You go so far as to put Frank Zappa in the vein of that other great Baltimore native and journalist H.L. Mencken, along the lines of what Mencken said in 1925. He complained about the American growing impatience with the free play of ideas, our increasing tendency to reduce all virtues to the single one of conformity. You draw a line right between Mencken and the goateed, long-haired, mold-breaker Frank Zappa.
Well, yes. I mean, maybe that's... I mean, a lot of people might think that's very, pretentious to do that. But I think they had a lot in common. I think Zappa was... an intellectual in that sense, the same way that Mencken was. I mean, he was also an iconoclast, and he did see the same dangers. I mean, Mencken was very prescient there, I think, that there is a danger if, particularly in a country where democracy is so spoken about and controls everything so much, that in the end there's always a danger that it flips over and becomes the will of the majority, and everything which is not the will of the majority is trampled underfoot. Rather than having a pluralistic society, you just have this one conforming society that the majority votes for. And this was always Zappa's big strength, was that he argued for freedom of speech, which to him was the main safeguard in America for democracy.
One can imagine how he'd be railing right now.
Oh, boy.
his physical image became a kind of icon of that time. He was so striking in appearance, with that hair, that very distinctive cut of the mustache and goatee. There was a kind of just burning magnetism in the way he looked. Was he aware of it?
Oh, yes. And also, don't forget, that was part of his rock and roll image. He was very, very aware that you have to sell yourself. You have to have a striking image for people to remember you. And particularly since he had no great advertising budgets behind him, and he wasn't doing the kind of rock and roll that would get into the top 100. So he had to make himself memorable. Also, From the earliest days onwards, when he was at school, he was always a bit of the class clown. This was his way of relating to people, so that he could always be a bit of a buffoon and not have to really relate directly to people that way. Mm. And in many ways, his rock and roll persona was just that. No one could get beyond the Frank Zappa image, the moustache, the little imperial goatee, and the whole look of him.
The other great epigram, well, there are a lot from Frank Zappa, but you remind us from Joe's Garage, where he says, "Information is not knowledge. Knowledge is not wisdom. Wisdom is not truth. Truth is not beauty. Beauty is not love. Love is not music. Music is the best." Could make you think for a long time, that Frank Zappa.
That's true. That's true. That I mean, that particular one, I mean, the more you analyze it, the more you think it shows, it does show that just exactly where he was coming from. That's his whole life philosophy summed up in that one little phrase.
Music, the best, and finally, Frank Zappa with his guitar. Just put among the greats as a guitarist, despite the fact that it was all straight out of the garage in the boonies of L.A.
That's it.
Barry Miles, it's been wonderful talking with you tonight. We're going to go out on 1991, one of his last guitar solos here performed in Prague in the Czech Republic, one of the places around the world where he was and is so well-loved. It's been a great tour, Barry Miles. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for your new biography, Zappa.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
On this dawn of a new peaceful and prosperous era for our country, I would like to wish for the best for Afghanistan. Oh God, make good the conclusion of our endeavor, such that leads to your approval and to our success.
Just as the National Security Act of 1947 was passed to prevent another Pearl Harbor, the Intelligence Reform Act will help us prevent another 9/11.
Why do we soldiers have to dig through local landfills for pieces of scrap metal and compromised ballistic glass to up-armor our vehicles, and why don't we have those resources readily available to us?
It's essentially a matter of physics. It isn't a matter of money. It isn't a matter on the part of the Army of desire. It's a matter of production and capability of doing it.
We are not suggesting the resignation or pushing for the resignation of the Secretary General. We have worked with him very well in the past. We anticipate working with him very well in the future for the time to come.
The Supreme Court today has expressed the fundamental values of Canadians.
Member countries which have responded to the market need for additional supply over the course of this year have agreed to collectively reduce the overproduction by 1 million barrels a day.
As the first African woman to receive this prize, I accept it on behalf of the people of Kenya and Africa, and indeed the whole world.
And there is a week. Hamid Karzai is sworn in as Afghanistan's first democratically elected president. Congress passes the Intelligence Reform Bill, which implements many of the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission. Donald Rumsfeld is grilled by soldiers about shortages of armor and other equipment. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations John Danforth gives Kofi Annan a vote of confidence after some members of Congress called for his resignation. Canada's Supreme Court clears the way for national gay marriage. OPEC announces a major cut in oil production to keep prices up, and Wangari Maathai is awarded the Nobel Prize, the first African woman to receive that honor. Jack, and out of all those voices of this week, that cry of Donald Rumsfeld from the big meeting with troops in Kuwait still resonates, and now his claims right there disputed within a couple of days of him making them, that it's physics that's holding up the equipment that's required.
Yeah, not according to the company that makes these. They've been asking the Pentagon since summer, hey, we can make 50 to 100 more of these a month. Just give us the order. No, it's a problem with the Pentagon, with Mr. Rumsfeld, that the it isn't physics. And, you know, the whole metaphor here of unarmored troops, I mean, this was a light deployment to Iraq because that's the way the secretary wanted it. And to this day, they haven't heavied up because, well, we're not facing tanks. No, but they're facing these roadside bombs, which are just as lethal. Rumsfeld, he's just too much. According to David Hackworth, who has sources in the Pentagon, he isn't signing the death letters to soldiers anymore. A machine is doing it. He can't bring himself. He can't spare the time.
He's not putting his own hand to it in the tradition
not
of Secretaries of Defense.
Now, if that's a metaphor for what? Alienation or guilt or I don't know what, but boy.
Maybe he thinks that's just old sentimental flip-flop.
Flim-flam. Maybe so. Maybe so. Maybe so. But it's got some of the families who've received these machine letters disturbed, and rightfully. I mean, my gosh, if he can't sign his own name. And, you know, this kind of thing, that what we're hearing daily from Iraq has had its effect on recruitment. According, again, to figures put out by Hackworth on his website, the Army and the reserves and the National Guard reserves are going to fall perhaps 50% beneath their quota for this recruitment season. That is a serious, serious hit. And according to the Seattle Times today, officers in the reserves are not signing up and going over, and captains, majors, and that this is creating a shortage of key personnel. Now, I guess this is a sort of market test, isn't it? These young men and women are seeing what's happening in Iraq, and they're saying, no, we don't want to join, and we don't want to stay with this, or at least more of them are saying that.
So I couldn't help thinking, though, Jack, we talked a lot about this week, and a full hour last night about the flap, and it got amazing calls from Fort Bragg area in particular, from soldiers with a lot to say. But this national focus suddenly on armor for Humvees, as important as it is, it seemed like a very narrow slice and, in a way, a sublimated conversation, kind of a different way of talking about the war itself, which the country can't quite bring itself. Maybe no one knows how to really talk about this war in broader terms because we're in so deep.
Yes, isn't that right? It's a kind of metaphor for we don't have the resources for the job.
And yet the job is spread out in front of us like some great big buffet and not a pretty one. Back in Washington, the intelligence bill goes through after all, after a lot of wobble. A week ago it looked like it might be put off and put off forever.
Yeah, it's a victory for the president. He did, although some people said he wouldn't and that he really wanted it to fail, he apparently did lobby strongly, and so did Vice President Cheney. They got their bill. But I was just listening to NPR, and I heard James Woolsey, former CIA director, saying, well, is this the answer to preventing another September 11th? Or would all this effort and money and all the bureaucracy that's going to be involved be better spent on hardening targets, and, as he put it, to prepare for the next time when we will be struck by terrorists? He was blowing one trumpet for this bill, feeling that perhaps it was, there was a diversion of resources that could be better spent elsewhere.
And yet, if it hadn't been passed, the president would be accused of pandering to the Pentagon. I mean, it's sort of damned if you do and damned if you don't. This was what the commission recommended after all those months of study.
It was, and, Susan Collins was just quoted saying this will prevent another September 11th or help to do it. I guess we can only hope so, but my gosh, the bureaucratic maze it's going to create for months and perhaps years. Well, all we have to do is look at the Department of Homeland Security to see what that'll be like.
Well, fingers crossed and off we go. Jack, have a great weekend. Thanks for being with
us. Thank you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Mata, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Rachel Dornhelm, Michael Garth, Cora Peterson, and Lauren Madelon. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.